have a system in this country of innocent until proven guilty, of hopefully an impartial judicial system, all of which this program confounds. And I'd like to be proven wrong. I'd like to see the stats and see that the worst fears that I have may not be well-founded, but I'm inclined to think that that's not going to happen. But I want to give the mayor the benefit of the doubt on this, and if it's six more months of really focused work to address the concerns that you're hearing from four of us here, I'm happy to do that. But at that time, I'm not sure that I can support the program.
I appreciate that, and also would like for you to know that we do take this very seriously. I know that, that the mayor has asked that we do a thorough study of what is going on, looking at the data, talking to the community, talking with the people who are involved, looking at people's opinions on both sides, and then putting all that information together and presenting it to you as recommendations. And we'll be happy to continue. I've started to send some data to some of you, some raw data and statistics. I'll be happy to keep doing that for all of you so that you can kind of begin to look at the data before we actually bring it all in one package to you.
But to be clear for me, even if the system were operating as functionally as is possible, I mean, all of the concerns you heard from Commissioner Sten and Adams and including Commissioner Saltzman were addressed positively, I still have to wrestle with this issue of whether or not it's appropriate for a police officer based on his or her judgment to be able to actually geographically exclude somebody from a particular area in the city without some kind of a conviction. That's troubling just on its face to me.
Okay. Thank you.
One of the major changes of this is that it has to be accompanied by an arrest. So there is probable cause that the person has committed a crime. And that's part of the exclusion process, and it has to go through the hearing process before the person is excluded to ensure that there is probable cause for the arrest. And the hearings officer has excluded some cases, but confirmed most of them.
I guess I heard just the opposite. That's why I can't wait to see the statistics. I heard that actually the hearings officer overturned most of them. Is that not the case?
Not the case, no.
So how does that break out?
I'll be wrong about the numbers. I think that the hearings office, I shouldn't even start talking about the numbers without them in front of me. It's less than, I think, 11% of overturned exclusions altogether. I think that the overturn rate for technical reasons is around 5%. Overturn for lack of probable cause in the reports, around 4%. I'm probably wrong. Close.
So what happens then in the next stage in the judicial system? If that adds up to 9%, then 91% of the folks the hearings officer found there was a probable cause to exclude. So at some point, those cases had to have been adjudicated based on the arrest in the court system. What has happened in the court system with those other 91%?
We're tracking that. And one of the things the committee is generating is valuable information for policymaking. You will have all that information. The cases take many paths through the criminal justice system. And we're starting to track now how many are dismissed, how many are dismissed in connection with another case, perhaps in a plea agreement, how many result in conviction. We may have those numbers at the table.
Yeah.
I'm happy to give them to you now.
I would love to see them.
Actually, we took a small sampling from early September when we first started implementing the exclusion ordinance, and also to give us the time to go through the criminal justice system. Out of 62 people excluded, 55 had prior criminal convictions of some sort in Oregon. There were 500 and... I'm sorry, I think I'm looking for my conviction right here.
The information.
These were prior convictions. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was that 89% had a prior criminal conviction for something. 75% of those folks had prior criminal convictions for a drug offense. So about three quarters. That's done in conjunction with an arrest.
I think we do have someone, person from Portland Police Bureau, it does have the conviction rate from that sampling that we did in September.
So we would have about three quarters if we limited it to people who had a record.
a record for the same offense.
Recorded, okay.
My name is Scott Partridge. I'm a crime analyst with the Police Bureau. The sample that we took in for the first 2 weeks of September, we had 64 exclusions, which involved 62 individuals. Of those individuals, I looked at their cases through the DA's office. The number of convictions as of the date that I looked at, which I believe was the end of February, 53% had received a conviction at time. Only 11% had received an outright dismissal. There were a number of cases still open. There were a number of cases that had received a dismissal in conjunction with a community court diversion or stop program.
So 53% of the 62 individuals excluded in September 06 went on to be convicted of the arrest that caused the exclusion?
Exactly.
52%. And
but what happened to the rest, though? You mentioned the stop court. There's some intervention strategies that were employed besides the prosecution.
That's right. And there
Can
were
you explain those? You know, those are acronyms, but they don't mean anything to folks who don't know.
You're probably more. I'm not.
Okay, the stop program is a drug court.
Right.
That actually looks at eliminating a conviction if the person goes through drug treatment. And I can't remember which of our judges instituted
okay.
that, but that's one of the programs. What were some of the other programs?
So that made, so these other 48% could be part of that diversion
they,
program.
They could be part of
okay.
a diversion.
Or they might still be in the process.
There
well,
were.
We should have, I mean, you should be able by the next time we have a report, tell us that. Okay.
If I can observe as something of an outsider to the group working to support, the group is starting the advocacy from the ends of the spectrum here, is starting to generate pressure to develop these numbers. They're asking some very tough questions, and the numbers are starting to flow. I think we're going to be able to answer many of your policy questions, given more time.
But to confirm a couple of other things that you've heard here, and again, I mean, I haven't checked any of this out, but the information I've got back was actually not just that the group was having a lot of challenges, but that it was actually a dysfunctional group. And so I'm obviously very concerned about getting recommendations from a group that has having problems communicating effectively with each other. And so I think we really need to take a look at who's sitting on the committee. And I'm very much in agreement with the perspective Commissioner Sten has given, which is they shouldn't be folks that have, you know, a professional stake in the outcome
sure.
of the game. It should be as impartial as possible, given the subject matter.
Further questions for these folks? Thank you. The folks signed up to testify on this matter?
We have five people signed up. The first three are Dan Handelman, David Walmer, and Chris O'Connor.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, state your name for the record. You each have 3 minutes.
Good morning again, City Council and Mayor Potter and Dan Handelman on Portland Cop Watch. And unfortunately, for people who are stopping these drug-free zones and giving these exclusions, if they miss their deadline to appeal the exclusion, it's just too bad for them. They're out for 90 days, and then if they get convicted, they're out for a year. But the council gave the police 9 months to come up with the numbers for this. They had 90 days before this renewal. The chief of police was supposed to give a report, and that didn't happen. There are no consequences. This council gave themselves 1 year to extend these zones, which have been around 13 years before that, to review it, and that has not happened. I think that the time is up. I think that you should not give an extension to this. I think instead you should look at the numbers that you have from the time period that has happened previously and suspend the zones until you have had a chance to look at them. I think the time is up. I think that this committee being created, Ms. Rubio said that these are open to the public. We are very invested in this issue. I had no idea when this committee came into existence. I happened to be in communication with Mr. O'Connor. I found out that it had started meeting, but I still don't even know when and where the meetings are taking place. So it's not very much of a public process at that. And I'm glad that there's questions coming up about the makeup of the committee. The ACLU, for instance, which helped Mayor Potter hold community meetings last year about the concerns the community had, as far as I understand, was not invited to be part of this committee. And I have word from Andrea Meyer at the ACLU that she would have at least liked to have been asked to be participant. I'm not sure she has time right now, but perhaps somebody from the ACLU can be on that committee, since they have studied this issue for a long time. And you know, I think Commissioner Leonard touched on the questions about the constitutionality of this. And I know that the courts have looked at the zones and said that if it's narrowly tailored, yes, it can be constitutional under these narrow conditions. But I think Commissioner Stan touched on the question of, is it good public policy? And I think that a lot of people's lives are affected by these zones. And we've been dragging this discussion on for so many years. And you know, it's good that we're finally taking some serious looks at it. But it just feels like we're just being shined on that, the committee had a long time to get up and running, and the one-year deadline is today, or it's Sunday technically. So I feel like City Council, I feel like the time is up on this, on drug-free zones, and hopefully you will suspend them until the research is done. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Chris O'Connor. I'm an attorney at Metropolitan Public Defender. I'm not here representing Metropolitan Public Defender, but as a citizen, I live on Beach Street right next to the beach, what was the beach drug-free zone right on the edge. I'm also the STOP attorney if you have any questions about STOP programs and alternative court processes. I'm also apparently a member of the Drug-Free Zone Oversight Committee. I was barely informed of this. There's been very limited information given to the supposed members of this committee. We've met twice. I believe the committee was formed after the state Senate proposed, there's five members of the Portland delegation proposed a bill to take state control of drug-free zones because of some concerns that they had. Then this committee suddenly appeared. Now, a year ago, this council renewed the zones for a year to allow data to be gathered, a committee to be formed for the police to do their own analysis within 90 days, which 90 days before the end of it, which is right there, right in the beginning of the ordinance, if you read the ordinance. And there was some serious concerns expressed by the council about why this data wasn't provided to the council during the last debate. This year was to do that, and the data has not been generated. The data that is generated for the oversight committee has been recalled. Whoops, we put the wrong data out. We're having trouble getting the data for the years past. The committee is primarily made up of advocates of the zone. I'd suggest there's myself as an opponent of the zone and one other member. The rest represent the business community or the police or city agencies or former members of the city agencies rather than neutral advocates. I would certainly support a more neutral committee process if the committee is to be renewed and the zones are to be renewed, there should be an extreme effort made to make a fair committee. My problem, my concern is that advocates, for instance, Ms. Rubio is leading the committee and deciding the agenda is advocate for the zones. There's attempts to shut down the discussion about whether or not there should even be zones based on probable cause to arrest. District Attorney's Office suggests that that's beyond the scope of the committee. Well, there is no scope to the committee. There's no list of guidelines as to what we're supposed to answer. There are no guidelines as to how are we supposed to come to these decisions. I suggested, Ms. Rubio suggested earlier that we all agreed that the committee agreed that the appeals process was working okay or adequately. I suggested taking a vote on that and was denied the opportunity to even suggest a vote on such a thing during the committee meeting. I'm concerned about the zones overall, but first and foremost, I'm concerned about the process. And I think the council's sort of had been misled as to what's been working the whole time and when it's supposed to be, when the data is supposed to be produced. And that was today. That's now. This should be done, and it's not. So I'd encourage you not to renew the zones and to, if we can discuss it, we can go over all the data and decide later if zones are appropriate. But why renew a system that isn't working? 20% of the prostitution cases are getting thrown out by the city hearings officers because there wasn't probable cause to arrest. 8% of the drug-free zones are, and according to the city hearings officer. And even today, this data I'm hearing is new to me, and I'm on the supposed committee about the these tracking these cases through the criminal justice system. I haven't seen that data yet.
Mayor Potter, members of the council, my name is David Walmer. For the record, I am the general manager of the Quality Inn and Suites at the old Pink Flamingo Hotel. I'm sure you're familiar with that property. And also a pastor at the church that owns that property. It's my understanding, we're fairly new to this process, my understanding that the tool of the drugs-free and prostitution-free zones has been a great tool for the police department to help clean up that area. And for the record, I would like to thank the East Precinct of the Portland Police Department for their efforts in helping us clean up that property. As you probably are aware, many people have said that property that we purchased was the biggest problem in Park Rose area. And because of their efforts, and I understand the two zones were instrumental in helping that process. And I would, as a public citizen, as a businessman in that area, I'd like to encourage the continuation of those zones. And let's get the data in. I share Commissioner Leonard's view and also these gentlemen's view that it needs to be done correctly. We certainly don't want to target people unfairly, and we don't want to exclude people that have no right to be excluded, but we do need to have control of the crime problems in some of those areas. So I would encourage you to go ahead and extend that time and time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our last two are Alejandro Carral and Mike Kuykendall.
Thanks for being here. When you speak, state your name for the record, and you each have 3 minutes.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Alejandro Carral, Director of the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center. I'm here this morning to urge you to vote against the renewal of the drug-free and prostitution-free zones. By suspending the exclusion zones now, the city has an opportunity to understand how the zones may be contributing to or may be facilitating bias-based policing or racial profiling. The ordinance encourages pretext stops because officers identify people in terms of how they look and where they are and not in terms of what they're doing alone. The fact is that exclusion orders are issued to people of color in numbers far greater than their share of the population. Nearly 60% of the 838 drug-free zone criminal counts handled by the Metropolitan Public Defenders between 03 and 06 were enforced against African Americans. Yet the prevalence of drug use among whites and African Americans is about the same. So if we compare this to the traffic sub-data from 2004 through 2006, in the central precinct, which includes the downtown exclusion zone, African Americans constitute 2% of the population, yet they're twice as likely to be stopped as whites. So council now has an opportunity to look at how exclusion zones may be allowing and, in a sense, encouraging bias-based policing by Portland officers. I urge you to consider this opportunity to better understand how certain policies that may at first seem like a good idea may be having a disparate impact on communities of color. Specifically, City Council could now take a look at or could commission a study that compares traffic and pedestrian stops data with and without the exclusion zones. Council could also look at how exclusions are enforced and the extent to which officers' discretion when arresting someone may be driving the racial disparity in the traffic and pedestrian stops. And Council could commission a thorough analysis of traffic and pedestrian stops data among exclusion zones. In other words, compare enforcement of exclusion ordinance among the different zones and compare with the pedestrian stops available. In short, I'd encourage Council to take a careful look at what is driving the data and what is driving the overrepresentation of people of color that are excluded to understand whether exclusion zones are exacerbating the racial disparity in traffic and pedestrian stops data. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Mike Kuykendall. I'm with the Portland Business Alliance. I'm also a resident of downtown, and of course, I work downtown. I'm here to encourage council to provide the six-month extension so that the committee can do its work. This ordinance has been in effect basically since 1993 in various parts of the city, and we have seen some tremendous results in terms of crime reduction. Homicides are down in North Portland where they were rampant 10, 12 years ago. Drug dealing is significantly down in downtown, out on 82nd. Meth dealing is significantly down. So we know that there's some good results of this. But I want to tell you all here today, as a committee member, I haven't made my decision either. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I think there's been some inaccurate statistics provided to council and to the oversight group. I know today, statistics, of course, are open to interpretation, but today we heard from One witness had said that the hearings examiner tossed out 8% of these because of lack of probable cause. And I sat in that very meeting, and the hearings examiner said that 8% were tossed, the overwhelming majority, because the box that said which zone was supposed to be affected, whether it's downtown or north or east, was not checked by the police officer. So there's a lot of information coming out of the Oversight Committee and out of the police department in terms of statistics that really needs to be analyzed. I'd support even having a group like Portland State's graduate program help us out with that. There's a lot of misinterpretation of the data. And so before we make a decision as an Oversight Committee and before council makes a decision about getting rid of this tool, it has been shown to be effective in terms of reducing drug crime and all the other types of crime, especially violent crime. We should be very, very very careful, consider it very carefully before we do that. The business community supports this extension. There are businesses in all three of the zones, and it's very important to us to at least let the process take hold. That's what I'm asking for today. Let the process take hold. Thank you.
Thanks, folks.
That's all who signed up.
Further discussion or questions? Please call a vote.
Did you want to do the amendments to these things?
Oh, or? Yeah. Yes, and each of them have the same amendment, is that correct?
Yes, there's a substitute for each ordinance.
Okay. Move the substitutes.
A motion to move. Do I have a second?
Second.
Please call the vote.
Leonard?
Well, I appreciated the comments that Mike Kuykendall just made from the PBA. Just to be clear, there is no doubt in my mind that drug-free zones have reduced the issues relative to drug use and sale and alcohol abuse in the affected zones. There should be no doubt in anybody's mind, just as there should be no doubt if people in this country didn't have the right under the Fifth Amendment not to self-incriminate, we'd have a higher conviction rate of people who committed offenses. So the issue for me isn't as much about the effectiveness of the zones as it is balancing the interests of the folks that live in our community to live in a free society, to be able to express themselves freely and to come and go freely, with the right people have to be secure in their beings and in their property. And so that I'm clear, I am increasingly concerned that that balance is not being achieved with the drug-free zones. And I will be unpersuaded that statistics showing that we've reduced the kind of behavior drug-free zones are intended to eliminate from those zones, if, in fact, when we get a report back in 6 months or thereabouts, it has been statistically shown that the drug-free zones have not been managed appropriately by the police. So it's with those caveats that that I will support extending this for 6 months, because I do want to, you know, on the side where I'm responsible to make sure that I do everything I can to protect folks in their being in their homes, I want to give this a chance. But on the other side, the constitutional issues that this raises are deeply, deeply troubling to me. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I'm also going to support extending the zones till September 30th. And I think that the substitute we're adopting that lays out the 8 parameters for the exclusion site oversight group to look at, the additional information provided by Maria Rubio about the statistical analysis that will occur are going to be helpful. I think you've heard doubts raised by all of us, or virtually all of us, about the composition of the committee. Can it really do meaningful oversight in a unbiased way? So that's something I'll leave to the sponsors of this work group to decide. But I do see kernels of information, statistics, starting to come out. Just today, we've started to hear some kernels of meaningful information that can help us decide the larger questions about the appropriateness of drug and prostitution-free zones vis-a-vis constitutional rights. But those questions will be looked at in September. And, I do urge, if this committee is not getting off the dime or is too entrenched, that the sponsors of this consider a more neutral group of citizens and have these people serve as resources to those citizens. Aye.
Finn.
I'll vote aye on the amendments and make my comments on the ordinance itself.
Potter?
Aye.
374 as amended.
Okay, then call the vote on 374.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Stinn?
I'm going to give a little explanation about my vote here. I do think that drug-free zones are valid tools. The basic premise of them is that we have people who are repeatedly dealing drugs in places, being arrested and having essentially no sanctions, and that because of the situation with the jail beds and other things, we have neighborhoods subjected to repeated drug use and drug dealing, and the traditional method, the preferred method, which would be an arrest and confinement for breaking the law, is not available or happening. I think that's a valid premise, and I think it's been proven to work. I have also consistently, and I think if my historical memory serves, I'm the only person on this body to ever vote against drug-free zones. They're very popular for the reasons I just described. But even before the events of this administration and a continuing erosion of the concept that you need to be innocent before proven guilty, I felt that this setup was dangerous. And it wasn't that it couldn't be used, and this is what has really galled me over the years about the drug-free zones, is that it unnecessarily, the way the city chose to set it up, compromised potential civil rights and freedoms. For literally 10 years, I've been asking for the statistics about how many people have prior convictions and have been stonewalled. And my reason for that is the way this was originally set up quite some time ago was if a police officer essentially accused you of anything, including drug possession, they could on the spot write an exclusion and you would be kicked out of the zone. If you were then found in the zone shortly afterward, you're guilty of criminal trespass. And so if indeed you had not possessed the drugs, you were now potentially found yourself in a criminally liable situation as an innocent person. And so I have advocated for years and will continue to advocate this morning that we should make the drug-free zone contingent upon having a record. The whole premise of the drug-free zone is that you're a repeat drug offender who is terrorizing the neighborhood and not going to jail. Therefore, in all likelihood, you've been convicted. If you have not been convicted, then I don't think it's too much to say we ought to get you convicted once before we start using civil penalties to exclude you. Because again, I think you no matter what I think or you think or anybody else thinks in this country, and I think that the I don't need to tell anyone in this room whatever their side they're on this, the merits of innocent until proven guilty. And I think this has tossed that out unnecessarily. Last year, and I want to compliment him very directly, Mayor Potter stepped in and said, I agree, this thing could be better run. And it isn't a question of should we have drug-free zones or not. We should have drug-free zones that sacrifice the minimum amount of civil rights necessary to make these things work. And we have not shot that ideal ever in the last 10 years until recently. With the hearings officer, we now have to have probable cause, which I think is a step forward, and the zone, and it does not go into effect until somebody's reviewed it, which is huge. It's a huge change. I greatly appreciate it. Now that we have the statistics, I think we should take a look and try and figure them out. And what begins to emerge is that I think the statistics would have been a lot worse in terms of probable cause if we didn't have this standard, because if people know those are the statistics, if they know that's the standard, they're going to work to that. So it really is an improvement already. That being said, we voted to give it a year, and at some point you have to say we have to be accountable to the timetables we set. If a community group had come back in and told us that we had given them a year to spend our money and they had started the process barely a month ago, they had forgotten what day the deadline was, so they needed an emergency vote, we would have said, we're really sorry, but that's not going to work. And so I think we need to stick to our word and say we did not do the work we said we were going to do to get these drug-free zones into the shape that they need to be in, and therefore a six-month extension is not warranted. And it's on the other side to figure out what to do next. So for those reasons, although I do think we are making progress, I am going to vote no.
Potter.
Well, this has been an interesting discussion, and I think a good discussion. I have had concerns about the drug and prostitution-free ordinances, and I think that in our society that we should place a high value on people's rights and freedom. And I think that really also applies to both sides, is that citizens have a right to be secure, not just encroachment from government, but also encroachment from criminals. And so there's always this careful balance that you try to have, and we've worked hard to try to create that balance. But I think that there are still a lot of questions remaining, and yet I think that the drug and prostitution free zones have proven themselves valuable, but there's many issues that we need to resolve. And I think that given the 6 months that we could come back with those issues presented in a way that would provide people the opportunity on this council to make a decision about whether this should continue or not. So I vote aye. It's emergency vote that failed.
I would make a motion to remove the emergency clause.
You can't, but I will, because it's already failed. You had to do that before it failed, but I will. Can I have a discussion, Mayor?
Yes.
I've thought a lot about this. I've worked hard with the mayor, who, despite some view, I'm not in a feud with, and we try and figure things out. He and I talked about this at great length yesterday. This is an emergency ordinance because the zones expire in 3 or 4 days, and that is an oversight which the mayor has explained to me, and we all make those kinds of oversights. The result of an emergency vote, for those of you who don't follow parliamentary procedure very closely, is that it has to be unanimous, and so the council just passed the concept of extending the drug-free zones 3-1, but it failed because I voted no. So I'm going to move for reconsideration and ask the council to reconsider the vote and give what I would call a courtesy vote to the majority so that it can take place immediately. Rather than vote yes and try and explain, I really don't support this, but I'm voting yes, which is the kind of thing that, folks like John Kerry lost the presidency over. I thought it would make more sense to vote no, beyond the record that I'm a no vote, and then offer a reconsideration vote. For those of you who are on my side of this, I don't think we accomplish anything by putting the drug-free zone out of business for 26 days, which is the net result if this comes back as a non. It could be refiled under a different category as a non-emergency vote, and it would pass 3-1, and then what would happen is the drug-free zone would die for 26 days, the interim from when it dies to when it would take place without an emergency clause. And I just think that creates nothing but an administrative headache for everybody. So I will, with that explanation, Mayor, move for reconsideration of item 374, if there's a second.
Second.
Please call a vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Stan?
Thank you, Mayor Potter, for working on this, and I do believe we will be in better shape in 6 months, and I hope if we're not, the council will join me. Aye.
Potter?
Aye.
So that allows you to reconsider. Now you've got to vote again on the ordinance.
Okay, vote on the ordinance.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. 375, vote on the amendment. Is that correct?
I believe you adopted both substitutes through the same motion, so you can call vote on the item as amended at this point.
Adams? I'm sorry. Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
No.
Potter?
Aye.
So for the same purpose, I wanted a no vote on the record. I will move to reconsider 375.
Second.
Call a vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Now vote on the continuance.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. We'll now move to go back to the 10:30 time certain. Mr. Saltzman?
I'll read the item 356. Direct Portland Parks and Recreation to adopt new sponsorship and naming policies.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. We have before us two new policies that will help us provide a fiscally healthier Portland's park system, while at the same time protecting our parks from overly commercial influences. These policies, in my opinion, strike the appropriate balance between protecting our parks from commercialization while still utilizing the private sector's willingness to give. I understand the angst this issue causes some folks, and that concern is appropriate. All citizens, but even more so, City Council, must watch over our public spaces and be stewards for their continued use by all. But the fact remains that taxes are limited, and many, many good programs and important services compete for these limited public dollars. Our wonderful park system has a unique ability to generate private investment. But park staff must have good policies in place so they know the rules of the road. This staff works daily to maintain and protect our parks, and they need the ability to utilize the resources of private entities that are willing to give and to utilize those resources in a respectful and appropriate manner. These policies on sponsorship and naming provide those rules. At this time, I'd like to introduce Parks Director Zeri Santner and Marketing and Business Development Manager Bob Schultz, who will go through these policies and answer any questions the Council may have.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. Zeri Santner, Director of Parks and Recreation. Caring for our city's parks and recreation system presents many, many challenges, such as increasing and changing community needs and expectations, aging and deteriorating assets, and uncertain revenue base. The Parks 2020 plan is a citizen-driven and council-adopted plan that guides the Bureau in addressing these challenges. I'd like to read the vision statement in the Parks 2020 plan. Portland's parks, public places, natural areas, and recreational opportunities give life and beauty to our city. These essential assets connect people to places, self, and others. Portland's residents will treasure and care for this legacy, building on the past to provide for the future generations. The plan also established several goals and strategies to bring this vision into fruition. One of the strategic goals is to provide for stable and predictable funding as competing demands in the city's general fund continue to increase. The plan identifies several short and long-term strategies for financial sustainability. Among those is increasing the proportion of funding that comes from gifts, grants, donations, and entrepreneurial partnerships, from less than 1% currently to 10% by 2020. During the past budget processes, at least in the past couple of years, staff and citizens have continued to stress the need to increase and diversify our revenue base by leveraging public dollars with private funds. Last December, we completed the staffing of the newly established Business Development and Marketing Unit within the Bureau, charged with advancing these goals. The unit will lead the Bureau's effort in expanding partnership and grant opportunities, marketing our gift catalog, securing sponsor for parks program and services, and in partnership with Parks Foundation, seeking private and philanthropic donations to keep Portland's parks and programs strong. The first task of this unit was to formalize some of the existing practices of recognizing sponsors and donors into a comprehensive policy and to update them for relevancy to our goals and consistency with our mission. The value of a formalized policy vetted by the public and approved by the council is that it makes the intent and outcome of how we move forward with private partnership very transparent. Bob Schultz, to my left, Manager of Business Development and Marketing Unit, will highlight the specifics of the two policies, especially those provisions that ensures that the way we recognize private contributions doesn't detract from the visitor's experience in our parks and facilities or compromise the stewardship and care of the legacy we've inherited as we continue to provide for future generations. I'd like to read you a quote that was included in the Parks 2020 plan by a citizen, Worth Caldwell, who participated in development of that plan. And he said, "It is one thing to plan the future, but quite another to see it carried out. A great deal of courage, perseverance, and energy will be required to see that this bold plan becomes a reality. the adoption of these guidelines that are indicated or provided in the two policies will give the Bureau additional tools to realize the Parks 2020 plan. So with that, I'm going to ask Bob to describe some of the salient points of the two policies that is before you.
Thank you, Director. Good morning, Mayor and Council members. As Portland Parks and Recreation's new marketing and business development manager, my first task is to move forward with finding opportunities to leverage private monies for improvement in Portland's parks, programs, and facilities. To that end, two policies are being brought to you today, the sponsorship policy and the naming policy. The sponsorship policy provides guidance for how we recognize partnerships where money is given with the expectation of recognition. In addition, any recognition of a sponsor shall not detract from the visitor's experience. All sponsorship proposals must directly relate to the intent of the community center, park, or master plan for that site. The mission of the sponsor should complement, not detract, from the mission of Portland Parks. For example, we would not make a partnership with a tobacco company because that conflicts with our mission for health. In addition, in recognition of a sponsor's contribution, preference will be given to provide recognition that's not displayed within parks. Examples of this recognition include acknowledgement on brochures, temporary signs, the website, thank you letters, and press conferences. This is not to say we would not recognize a contribution at a park, but it should be done so that it does not detract from the visitor's enjoyment of the park. And recognition of a sponsor should be commensurate with the value of the contribution. A defined period of time and the life of the asset being sponsored will be considered. Logos are a concern for the public, and we've heard from them about that. We've addressed this in our policies. Logos can only appear on temporary signage or plaques for the life of the sponsorship. For example, a banner might appear in a summer program in a park, which indicates the sponsorship of a certain program for youth, such as a basketball league. The marketing and business development manager will make the determination of type of recognition to be provided. The naming policy is a guidance for donations and other arrangements where naming a park facility or amenity is an option. First, I'd like to note that this is not a new policy, but simply amending an old policy. This update allows us to acknowledge major contributions for capital projects. It does not allow for the naming of a park after a corporation. Any corporate logos or direct advertising text shall not be used in the naming text of a park or facility. Recognizing outstanding individuals and historic events are also requests that are made to Portland Parks. This policy helps provide guidance for those decisions. The name should project a strong positive image, be appropriate in regard to the site and location and history, and have significance for future generations. It should not result in undue commercialization of the park or facility, and perhaps most importantly, it should have wide public support. Naming of an amenity within a community center or park can take place when the sponsorship constitutes at least 60% of the total construction cost of the amenity. All naming requests will be considered by a standing committee. This committee will include the Commissioner of Parks or designee, Director of Parks or designee, the Director of Office of Neighborhood Involvement or designee, a representative from the Oregon Historical Society, and a park board member. Final approval will be made by the Commissioner of Parks. I want to talk to you just a moment now about the public process that we went through before we brought you these policies this morning. Before we brought you these policies, draft versions of them were taken to the Parks Board for their review and comment. Citizens were also given a 6-week time frame over our website to give us their comments. The citywide Parks team monthly meeting was another venue for us to help gather public opinion. The meeting was advertised on our website and various blogs, as well as through radio and television. Articles about the meeting also appeared in print media, including a very substantial article in the Oregonian. We then went back to the Parks Board for the third and final visit to get their approval. We made changes based on their input and feel confident that these are ready for your approval today. We welcome your questions.
Questions?
Can you point me to the section that doesn't allow the naming of parks?
Sure. For corporations?
Yes. Or in, not just corporations, any contributor.
We can name a park for a contributor. I don't understand. In other words,
well, let's start broad and then get narrow. Just point me to the part where where it doesn't allow the naming for.
Okay, if you want to talk about where it doesn't name for a contributor, on the bottom of page 2.
I'm talking about, you said corporations.
So corporation, yeah. Naming parks and or recreational facilities with a company name is not permitted by the way of city code.
Point me to that, please.
Very top of page 3.
Of the naming policy.
Uh-huh, naming policy.
Top of page 3, I'm there.
Yeah, that's the end of it. It starts with the first 3 or 4 words on the bottom of page 2. So, naming parks and or recreation.
Maybe I'm looking at, I'm looking at your draft, Exhibit A, parks.
Yeah, this came directly off the website.
Is that Exhibit A that you're discussing? You said page 3, and I went to the Exhibit A, page 3, and I didn't see it.
Okay, I'm not sure. We pulled these directly off
Exhibit B.
Exhibit A is sponsorship. Exhibit B is naming.
Well, that'll help. It's the naming policy. I'm sorry.
Okay. Page 3, did you say the bottom?
It actually starts on the very bottom of page 2, naming of parks and or. It's on the very hand, on the very bottom. How are we there?
Are we looking off the same draft?
No, it's right here.
I think it printed out.
They printed differently from you. This came directly off our website, so I apologize. I don't know who printed what.
Well, I need to be pointed to where it is and what I'm looking
at. Okay, I'd be happy to do that.
Where is it? Okay. Maybe you can read it so I make sure I'm read the entire relevant section that you say prohibits corporate naming.
Okay, I can read the whole paragraph here. Donors seeking naming rights for major donations with respect to all individuals were encouraged to follow the principles that apply to naming a park for an outstanding person.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I am just completely lost. I am not.
That Harry's got your
copy. I'm seeing naming / renaming for historic events, comma, people, and places, and it starts out, when a park and or recreational facility.
I was jumping down below that. Then you've got naming for major donations in the next category.
Naming for major donations, okay.
Then you've got land, and there's 3 bullets there, land for majority, blah, blah, blah.
So can you read the part that you're saying prohibits?
Sure.
Okay.
So after you get past the 3 bullets, then you get into another paragraph, which I was starting to read the whole thing.
Okay? Yes, I'm there.
Okay, so do you want me to read the whole paragraph or
I
just
would.
The part? Okay. Donors seeking naming rights for major donations with respect to an individual will be encouraged to follow the principles that apply to a naming park for an outstanding person. Exceptions to this will be considered on their own merits. Portland Parks and Recreations reserves the right to rename any park or facility if the person for whom it is named turns out to be disreputable or subsequently acts in a reputable way. Naming parks and or recreational facilities with a company name is not permitted by way of city code. Corporate logos, insignias, brands, or direct advertising text will not be used in a park. Shall not be used in park or recreation facility naming text.
But this doesn't prohibit the naming of a park or after someone, just if it's a company name.
Yeah, and I'm happy to explain that further because this has been one of the things I think that's been a little confusing. And what we're talking about is that we will not name a park after a company name. However, if there's an amenity within a park or a facility that we want to work with a corporation to help pay for, then we would maybe there may be a gazebo, let's say, in a park that a company might want to represent. So if it's in Dawson Park, the gazebo may have a company name at that point. However, if we did name the gazebo, it would not have any advertising text. In other words, you know, whatever the company's slogan was, we wouldn't put that there.
So I see, it also talks about not doing that for recreational facilities, but under definitions, I don't see a recreational facility. I do see a definition for a community center. Is a community center the same as a recreational
facility? If you go to the very first page under definitions, there's a definition bullet that says recreation facility.
I'm at Exhibit A again. So you're talking back to Exhibit B.
Yeah, we're still on B. Yeah, I'm sorry.
And that's on the very first...
First page, there's four bullets that appear, and the very third bullet is recreation facility.
Not on my page.
It's on page
one.
Two.
It's on page,
top
page two. Definitions, major structures such as community simples. Okay.
Right. Okay.
So, Terry, what's the logic between not bringing at some threshold to the council?
Under 10,000, many of our staff, our community centers.
Does over 10,000 come to the council or to the commissioner in charge?
The commissioner in charge.
Right. So my question is why wouldn't ones over, if not something, some threshold, come to the council and allow the citizens a debate? I mean,
there's no reason. And if
you guys have, you know, I think falsely been accused, to be honest, of trying to do things out of the public eye. And I think this just sets you up to go at it once again. You make a decision that seems reasonable in the confines of your piece. We read about it in the paper, and there you are again. You know, we're having a big debate as to why did you do it. I mean, transportation can't name a street without the vote of the council. Parks shouldn't be able to name a park.
We are happy if that's the council's decision to do that. You need to be reminded that currently, up till now, naming of a park could be done with just by the director of parks. So we're expanding commissioner's role, and we're also providing an opportunity for a committee to make recommendations rather than a director coming up deciding on the naming. If that's the desire of the council, we're happy to consider it.
Well, I don't know that I particularly have a great desire to be in the driving force on naming parks, and I think you guys have a good committee structure and the right people coming into it. It's just there's no notice public hearing in that process. And so, I mean, what I see the council as potentially having the ability to do is have a hearing that's noticed that people, because if somebody objects and says, well, this person had the disreputable behavior that you're outlining,
right.
And you don't know that we have no way of getting that kind of information. And I don't think the citizens are going to be able to track your process. And so I just think it would be safer to have some sort of threshold under which I don't think it could be higher than 10,000 as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't need to be 10,000, but there ought to be some threshold where a citizen knows there's not going to be a sponsorship of some kind, a naming of some kind, without them having a clear chance to catch it in the public record along with the press and debate it in these chambers.
Right.
Can I ask a question? Sorry. I think what I want to ask, Commissioner, is you seem to be walking between the two policies a little bit, and I want to be clear just so that I can help with the conversation. If we're talking, because we were started with Commissioner Leonard's comments about the naming policy, and I just heard you refer to the sponsorship policy. So if, in fact, what you're suggesting is that any sponsorship opportunity of $10,000 come to the council for a debate, that that's a whole different story than if a person wants to name a park and come to the council for a debate. And I'm not saying that shouldn't happen, but what I really want to know is that what you think we should be saying here?
Well, I'm looking at the definition under naming, and it says the permanent name assigned by city council via an ordinance.
Right,
so
right.
Naming come
comes
to the
before
council.
City council, and, right. And basically, if you're an individual who wants to have a park named, you have to have either made significant contributions to society, the city, and lasting generations, or you can make a major contribution of 60% or greater of the construction costs. Now, on the sponsorship
still
side,
comes to council for
that
support.
Comes to council. On the sponsorship side, what we've said is that the marketing and business development director makes the decisions for the type of recognition. And to give you an example of one of those that we have is the Freightliner Summer Concert Series, where Freightliner sat down with us and gave us the first year $175,000 to support our summer concert series in exchange for where we advertise on our brochures for the concerts for them. Now, if that's the kind of decision that you think should come to council each time we have one, we're going to keep you very busy. And so I just wanted to clarify that.
Well, I think there should be some threshold, and I'm
okay.
Suggesting that you propose it to us.
Okay.
I think the threshold of no council involvement is too low.
Okay, and that's to be clear. We're here today. We're not in an emergency situation or anything. We're just here today because we wanted to get these policies vetted at this level.
Well, I think I'm both. I think you should give us some sense. You're proposing essentially other than the permanent naming of the parks, the council doesn't have a role in it. And I'm saying I actually don't think that's in your interest based on the controversies you've been through the last couple of years. I think those are the things that people go after you sometimes falsely on. It's sort of this was done without enough public process, and I don't think your internal processes get to the public's attention. And so I think there has to be some, if you have another mechanism that you'd rather use rather than a council vote to get it to the public's attention, I'm open to that. I just think that when we start talking big ticket items, there has to be some chance for people to look at it. And right. And over the years, I've become actually less supportive of putting some of these names on than I used to be. I think it.
Well, I'm working real hard at biting my tongue. And the first time, Commissioner Stan, you referred to the Parks Bureau's falsely being accused of not having public process, I bit my tongue. You said it twice. I don't think you've been falsely accused of that, and we've gone over it. So I'm just telling you from my perspective. A submission of an ordinance that requests sponsorship or the naming of a park can go on the consent calendar. We each read each item on the consent calendar. If we think it's worthy of discussion, we can pull it off. So I'm not worried about it being bogged down. I am worried about, at this point in time, the discretion used by parks when it involves private sector folks with money. And so I want as much oversight as possible.
Great. Thank you.
If I can just make one observation, the agreements that you enter into with the sponsors typically do come to the council for approval.
Right. Absolutely.
The Freightliner one did, the one Nike for Selwood was. Park did, the Nike yeah. one did. Yeah. So the council will have an opportunity to review those agreements, and you can make a report on your sponsorship.
Sure. And part of this is with the new department, we're going to be producing annual reports that talk about our partnerships and the good work we can do. Example, the Nike Go program, we're helping fight children's obesity. So they're actually investing in the system so that kids can have better access. Those are the kind of partnerships we're talking about that have very low recognition.
Commissioner, going back to your suggestion about setting thresholds, we have established threshold of 60% of total costs for any projects or programs if it's contributed by sponsors or donors. So that's a threshold that we've set, and we want to know if you're comfortable with that. And
no, that sounds reasonable. I'm just talking about a threshold that it has a public vote of the council.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, I'm not comfortable with that. I think anytime the parks gets money from the private sector, we should be able to have an opinion. And it can be as simple as an item on the consent calendar that takes absolutely no more time at all to do than what you're normally doing, but gives each of us the opportunity to make the judgment as to whether or not accepting money from a particular individual or corporation is appropriate for the funding of our Portland parks.
Okay.
And Council, we will do that. And we have done that in the past all the time, as Harry reminded of us.
Okay, I'm hearing two things, though. I'm hearing there's a 60% threshold, and I'm hearing we do it all the time.
A 60% threshold is kind of
the internal naming. Yes.
It's the internal guidance to the parks people about how do you get to a naming.
Naming. Mm-hmm.
It still has to come to council, the decision to do the name via ordinance.
I'm just asking.
But for their own working purposes.
Whether it's for sponsorships or whether it's
for
the naming of a park, irrespective of either of those two categories, I think it's an entirely appropriate function for the council to at least have the opportunity to weigh in on that. And you can do that very simply via the consent calendar every time, and only if somebody has a concern, they can ask it to be pulled off and discussed.
Okay.
I think that's already being done, but yeah.
Well,
I mean, I don't.
Now you lost me, because on one hand, I'm hearing that the commissioner in charge makes the decision.
Okay, this
what
is
you're saying is once the commissioner in charge makes the decision, the council has the right to revoke it when you file. That's not good policy. I mean, it should be that the decision gets made, and then the person knows that it's going. And that's why I do think it should be. I don't agree with Commissioner Leonard. I think it should be a higher threshold than all sponsorships. I think that small sponsorships, you know, we ought to leave with the commissioner in charge and the director as they see fit, and they should take their glory and the pitfalls with it. But as you get to bigger deals, I want you guys to propose something that works for you. But mm-hmm. the idea that we just sign off after the handshake puts us in the position of saying, okay, we don't think this is appropriate, but the Parks Commissioner has already agreed to it. so let's block it. So I don't think you bring it to us for approval. I think you bring it for us to us for contract authorization, which is a little bit different. Mm-hmm.
So in order for me to be clear, Commissioner Stan, you're suggesting that the naming
I'm saying
policies,
both the sponsorship and the
both,
naming
both on sponsorship
should have some threshold
naming, right.
at which it comes before the council, whether it's on, you know, whether it's on consent or regular is actually a function of whether anybody there's any opposition.